We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores of the games every day? Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment.
I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to Laker Film Room Podcast, brought to you by betonline.ag. I'm Pete, joined as always by Darius. As we mentioned in the last episode, the way these are going to be structured for the time being is, on the front end, we're going to give kind of updates to the extent with which we can. We're not experts, but just talk about the coronavirus situation on the first half of the show. And then Darius and I, you know, our favorite show, we share that in common. We're going to be doing this rewatch of The Wire and doing that in the second part of the episode. So yeah, we'll do, you know, coronavirus and Lakers stuff in the first segment. We'll have, you know, longer Lakers parts than we will today. We did get the news that, you know, two Lakers were diagnosed with it today. So we'll get into that in a moment. But we opened our last episode. Darius in Alameda County had just been put under kind of lockdown, right? Shelter at home, shelter in place, right?
Yes.
Sure. California Governor Gavin Newsom issued the order today. We're recording this Thursday night, that starting at midnight, so that's like 2.5 hours from when we're recording this, the whole state of California is going into that. And so, we kind of theorized that maybe the Bay Area would be a harbinger for what we'd see elsewhere, not only in the state, but in the country going forward. And so far that's shown itself to be true. So I just want to ask you, man, is like, what is the experience of actually living under what a lot of the rest of us in LA will be under? What has that been like for you? What do you think we can expect?
I mean, I can only speak for myself. I've been trying to follow this as closely as I can, both on Twitter and then watching way more news than what I've probably watched in the last like 4 years combined. Like, I don't think I've watched this much news since maybe like the run-up to the 2016 election, honestly. Most of my time is around the Lakers and my family and all the things that are important, right? And so this has leaped to like the front of the line in a lot of ways. And so I provide that context because over the last week or so, it seemed like this was what was basically the recommendations of a lot of the medical experts. Like, you shouldn't be leaving your house for much, if anything, at all. Only to do essential things if you have to go grocery shopping or you need to go to the doctor for like serious, you know, conditions, right? Like, not like, oh, this is my monthly checkup. Here I am for my physical, right? Not like that. picking up prescription meds, or even just to get out to like exercise, right, while still maintaining or operating under like social distancing. And so we've sort of been doing this even before our counties sort of shut down the way that they did. So for me, it hasn't been too drastic of a change from what it was like the 2 or 3 days before that. I will say that to have the governor come out and say it like the way that he did today, it causes anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's just more anxious times, right? Like I feel like the rate in which there were more confirmed diagnoses up here in the Bay Area, I think that that sort of triggered in at least our minds up here locally that this was already super serious, right? Mm-hmm. But to have the governor basically say, like, he didn't just limit this to, you know, the major metropolitan areas, the Bay Area and Los Angeles. He basically said, this is the whole state, right? Mm-hmm. And there was that letter. I'm not sure if you saw the letter that got leaked online, right? And so he laid out some pretty massive numbers in terms of what he was anticipating or expecting. And who knows if that's hyperbole, but that's like a giant number, man.
Yes, right? Yes.
So
can you explain to listeners that may not have seen that, like what it was?
Yeah. So there was a letter, I guess, today that surfaced online today from Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, to President Trump or the White House, basically saying that he needed as many resources as he could. He asked for one of the large naval hospital ships to be there were two, apparently, and he asked for one of those to be deployed off the coast of Los Angeles. Because he anticipated the number of confirmed infections over the next 8 weeks to go up to like 25 million.
Yeah, 56% of the state. Yeah.
So that's what I was talking about in terms of that massive number. So obviously, if that's an idea that even if that doesn't become realistic, if that's a scenario that leadership in this state is operating under as being realistic, then that's just scary, man. And it's problematic in so many ways. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that all of those cases will be severe and that everyone will be sick and need all of this stuff.
It's 25 million people at a 1% mortality rate. That's 250,000 deaths, man.
So it's just a massive, massive number. And it's scary. So I try not to be a panic type person.
No.
I think that probably comes through. Well, I just think in general, if people like follow me online or like read my writing, right? They
kind of
get
the sense. Yeah, we go on a 3-game losing streak. You're not.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the Lakers. It's real life. We'll get to the Lakers shortly, right? But this is something different, and so. Like for me personally, I've just been taking it one day at a time. We're trying to do our best. We're cooking good meals. We're trying to have good family time. And that's basically it, right? Like I've definitely found myself having more conversations with friends and just reaching out, how you doing, that type of stuff, right? But for the most part, I'm with many of the people I love. I'm doing a Wire rewatch. I'm trying to keep up on news. I'm doing a little bit of writing, wrote a piece on Vlade Divac that posted today at Silver Screen and Roll, right? Like I think that for me personally, I'm just trying to keep up with as much of my normal life as I can, considering that it's not at all normal.
Right.
So,
and that's, you know, that's the best that we can do. You know, there are going to be a lot of ramifications from this, even outside of, you know, how many people get sick and pass away from it. And some of the news that we got today, you know, it's funny with Newsom, you know, releasing that figure. And that's what the scientists and doctors had been predicting, you know, especially people who study pandemics and things like that, that between 40 and 70% of the population would probably come down with it at some point. Right. Which isn't to say the vast majority of them are not mild, right? Like that's how it goes, but those numbers had been out there before. It's just hearing the governor say that is like, oh, that puts it, that makes it more of a reality. And what makes it even more of a reality today is the news that two Lakers had been diagnosed with that.
Yeah, I will say too, just before we move on to the Lakers, what concerned me most about the letter that Governor Newsom wrote was the timeline of that, right? Like 8 weeks is not a long time. No. Now, these weeks now seem to be like moving in slow motion, mm-hmm. like Neo in the Matrix, right? The way he's dodging bullets, that's how these days are passing. We talked about that the last pod where we recorded on a Monday or whatever, and it was just a week before that we were talking about the Bucks and Clippers games. Mm-hmm. We're recording this now on a Thursday. It was literally only 8 days ago that the NBA suspended their season.
100 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, man. So I mean, 8 weeks may end up feeling like a really long time based off of the way that time is moving now, mm-hmm. but it's really not. Mm-hmm. 8 weeks is not a long time. Like, my kids are 8 and 6 now. I could not tell you where those 8 and 6 years went in a lot of ways, right? So time can move very quickly on you. And so to think that over the span of something like that, we could see literally, you know, tens of millions of more people be diagnosed with this. And that's the thing, like the lack of testing and everything else, which I think this is a good place to pivot to the Lakers, right? Mm-hmm, in terms of the testing and everything else. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, just Shams Charania from The Athletic reported today that two Lakers tested positive. The Nets were the last team the Lakers played before this hiatus, and the Nets last week had 4 guys test positive. Marcus Smart was announced to be tested positive as well today. I think that, you know, with those numbers, I think in, you know, a week or two, we're just not going to hear about individuals anymore because it's going to be so much more pervasive if those numbers of, you know, 56% or, you know, even if it's the low end of that of 40% of people getting it. And like so many of these guys, especially in the NBA, they're in peak physical condition. They're in their 20s and 30s. They don't have, you know, underlying conditions that make them compromised. They're going to be fine individually, right? And the point of them quarantining and isolating is the same as what's going to be true for the vast, vast majority of us, is to not endanger other people, right? And to help slow the spread of this and not overwhelm the hospital system, flatten the curve, all of that stuff. But it does add just a certain degree of gravity. We don't know who it is on the Lakers, but like there's going to be more and more reports of this coming out until it's so pervasive that like it's not even really newsworthy anymore. But so yeah, they tested the Lakers on a couple of days ago, got the
Wednesday.
Results. On Wednesday, got the results today on Thursday. And two guys came back positive. They aren't showing symptoms, according to the Lakers, and they're isolating, quarantined, being taken care of by the team physician. I don't have much to add on it, honestly, because this is like what's going to happen. But how did you take the news?
Well, I sort of business as usual, honestly. And so obviously, the Lakers news broke before the Marcus Smart news broke. But with the 4 Nets who tested positive, and then the players Gobert and Donovan Mitchell from the Jazz, and then you hear of all of these other teams who have been tested, it's just one of those things where you had to figure that eventually this was probably going to happen to members of the Lakers organization as well, right? Like there seems to be no avoiding this in a way. It's like, how many people do you find that like have found a quarter on the street, right? Mm-hmm. like it seems like that's how common this is going to end up being. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to this podcast yet, but Danny Green was actually a guest on Howard Beck's podcast today that came out, the Full 48 podcast, which is a Bleacher Report pod. And Danny Green talked a little bit about the process around the Lakers in terms of getting tested and what that was like a little bit. At the time of Danny Green's interview, he had not received his results yet. So it sounds like this was probably recorded earlier today, if not like yesterday. But it was interesting to hear Danny Green sort of just talk about the process in which what the Lakers were doing as a team before this. So he had mentioned that players were still going to the facility to work out, that they were being issued like staggered workout times for them to come in and get their own personal work in, both skill development work and work like on the court, and then shifts in the weight room as well for them to be able to work out in staggered shifts in order to keep up with social distancing policies and whatnot. And so he said that it was actually near the end of the day on Tuesday that they had gotten the news of the Nets players who had tested positive. And so Danny Green was actually saying that the Lakers were sort of starting to see a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel, right? So like they had been getting some work in, there had just been a report, or the league had basically said that it would be okay for players to travel out of their home area very recently. So he was saying that in conversations that he had had amongst his teammates, like amongst the Lakers players, that guys were already starting to make plans to leave town, basically, because they would have that opportunity. And then the news came towards the end of the day and everybody sort of seemingly slumped down a little bit, right? Because that meant that they were going to have to go into quarantine for 14 days because they had been in contact with people who had been confirmed as positive tests. And then testing was going to be made available to them the following morning. And so he did say that almost everybody did go test, but that apparently there were players who did not, which was part of Shams reporting as well, right? That the players who did not get tested were now likely to get tested. And beyond that, it now seems like other members of the Lakers organization who have been in close contact with players, probably some of their coaches and skill development guys and training staff, I would imagine, right, that they're going to get tested now as well. So the dominoes are really starting to fall to me, and we can pivot after this, but it just goes to show, man, that like it really was important that the league shut down when they did. It could have been really problematic if even two or three more games had been played. Like, look, the league shut down on a Wednesday. The Lakers were scheduled to play the Rockets on Thursday, and then they were scheduled to play back-to-back games with the Jazz, right, in a home and away split. So there was going to be massive opportunity for this thing to go sideways really quickly across the entire league in a way that really would have been problematic. So you can argue that the league didn't move quick enough in a lot of ways, but thank goodness they sort of shut things down at the time that they did.
Yes. No, that's, I think the league can, you know, kind of get some beneficial whistles when it comes to evaluating some of their decisions at times. I think that they've handled this relatively well so far. We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to shift to some much needed fun to our Wire rewatch. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. With currently no NBA, NHL, or college basketball, you might think there's nothing to bet on, but you'd be wrong. BetOnline still has hundreds of places to wager. From their online casino to poker and blackjack, all open 24 hours a day and all online. Sports aren't totally done. There's still mixed martial arts and esports is on the rise. If you're into entertainment, you can still bet on American Idol, the elections, the spelling bee, and even Nathan's hot dog eating contest. Be sure to use promo code BLUEWIRE to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, your new ticket to online action. All right, so before we continue, you guys had sent in several questions that we will definitely be answering in the next episode or over the next couple of episodes about the Lakers, about, hypotheticals, the season. This is the time to get into all sorts of stuff because we just found ourselves with a sudden offseason, except there's no draft to look forward to. There's no free agency. There's no, like, we know what our team is. We don't even know if the season's continuing. So we will be probably entertaining some things that maybe we would not have time to entertain otherwise. But as I said in the last show and at the top of this one, Darius and I, like, our favorite show is The Wire. That is something that we've had in common since before we met each other. And we are starting our rewatch of that. If if you have Amazon Prime, you can find it for free on there. And I'm sure there are other places we can help you find links for that and all that. But we're going to do, it's on HBO as well, of course. That's where it originated. So what we're going to do in this episode, so it is kind of like lay the framework. There are actually two things I want to talk about. If we can get to it, is the opening scene with Snot Boogie in the first episode, right?
Yeah. About Snot Boogie. Yes.
About Snot Boogie. Yeah. Yeah. Snot Boogie, unfortunately, was not, he did not have any speaking parts.
No line readings for Snot Boogie. He may not have gotten his SAG card for that.
So let's talk about that. Cause this first episode was written by David Simon, who's the show's creator. Sure. And he's the guy, he was a journalist in Baltimore working like the police beat. So he had a lot of insight and kind of into this world and borrowed heavily from those experiences in creating this really amazing story that spans over the course of five seasons. If you're not familiar with The Wire, it's basically about every element of the drug trade in the city of Baltimore. And this is early 2000s is when it was, when it aired, early to mid 2000s. And so it's really fascinating. And for me, like, you know, film breakdowns, this very much appeals to like my film breakdown part of my brain, because it's really about one thing for five seasons, but it's about all of the different aspects of it. So it's like really getting into the details. I love it. Right. I think that it's important, like the very first season, the very first scene of the very first show in the very first season written by the creator of it, like he's trying to tell us something creatively, right? Like this is what the show is about, or this is the first thing that I have to say to you. What do you take? How about this? Describe the scene. I know you're going to do great at this. Describe the scene and what did you take from it?
Well, I mean, so the show opens, and I can't remember if the first pan of the camera is on the two characters or if it's on the dead body that's in the street. But obviously, there's a bit of unfolding, and there's two characters. One's a cop. We end up finding out this guy's name is McNulty, and Detective McNulty. And then the other character is just a random person, a guy from the neighborhood. And McNulty is talking to him about the dead body that they either just shown or are about to show that's laying in the street. Mm-hmm. And they have this conversation. And it's funny because the way that this show goes, people are sort of like, when's it going to get going? Right. Mm-hmm. But for me, I don't know if this was the same for you, but I'm already hooked by the time that these two guys are having the dialogue that they're having. Right. Just the flow of the conversation and what they are talking about and how authentic it feels between these two people having this conversation about what they're talking about is just riveting to me. Mm-hmm. And so McNulty is not interrogating this guy. He's more just asking him questions about like, so what happened? And the guy is explaining to McNulty that, well, you know, he doesn't quite tell him exactly how it went down. He's talking to him about almost his relationship and what these guys do on an everyday basis, right?
Like, he's what their life, like the environment, right? You're like, yes, what like, is the world that they're operating in? Yes.
Like what their life is like. And so he's explaining a crap game. And the best part is when he's saying, you know, like, well, you know, and he does this same thing, like
why
every
do you
time.
Even let him in the game? Yeah.
and so ultimately it gets revealed that this guy gets killed because every time that him and his buddies are shooting craps, he waits for the pot to get really big and then he snatches up all of the money and runs. And he runs and he tries to steal it. And every single time he gets caught and
they whip his ass.
They kick his ass. And then they get their money back. And McNulty sort of incredulously asks him, like, well, like,
why do you even let him in the game?
Why do you even let him in the game? And dude's response, and do you have the quote?
No, yeah, he said, you got to. This is America, man.
And this like, is his America, response, man.
Well, like the first thing he said is like, why do you even let him in the game? And he's like, what? Like, he didn't even consider that as a possibility, right? And like, I think that's revealing in that part of, and we're about to get into this with the cops along with the Barksdales. Part of what's revealed with the Barksdales especially is that like, you take care of your people, right? Like good or bad, like Snot Boogie, who got his name because his, you know, that was just his nickname, right? Like that's what everyone called him. Snot, like for better or for worse, he was one of theirs. And like, yeah, he'd fuck up and he'd steal their money. They'd whip his ass and the score was settled. And like this guy was lamenting like you don't got to do that, right? Like, yeah, like he's one of ours, right?
Yeah, almost like this was a step too far within the game, right? And so the game is something that we will get to over the course of our rewatch, because to me, it is the thread. It is one of the main threads of the fabric of the entire series, right? Like the rules of the game and sort of honor and code. And this exists on both sides of the drug game, both from those perpetrating the drug game and then the police who are trying to stop it and thwart it, both from like a narcotic side and from a murder side. And so the friend was sort of like, you didn't have to kill him over this, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's just part of the game. Like, you know, just beat his ass, get your money back, and then that's it. And then, you know, and then next Friday we'll do the same thing.
That's right. This is what happens, right?
And this is our life. Right. And so that scene to me just sort of sets the entire thing off within the context of code and rules. And then to me, over the course of the first episode, and then especially in the second episode, those things start to be refined even a little bit more, and the curtain gets pulled back a little bit more as to what sort of the code is amongst both sides. And and it's super interesting, man. Like, but let me ask you a question. So episode one, there is a lot that happens in episode one, right? There's like the whole court scene that happens with D'Angelo, who's on trial. There's the opening scene with the judge, we talked about, right? There is the McNulty stuff in terms of his conversations with the judge. There is an introduction of all of these cops who very quickly we start to see this strong character development as to who these guys are. So what was your favorite part in like the rewatch, right? Because I wanted to ask you that, but also like how many times have you rewatched this?
So this is my third rewatch. So okay. I guess
this is number four for me.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting, you know, when you watch it, like knowing how the story progresses, certain interactions, like, oh, I caught that little like, I don't want to spoil anything, but just caught little interactions between characters where you're like, I see why that happened that way. What really, so my favorite part about this is the introduction of the two different organizations, the Barksdale organization and the Baltimore Police Department. And the Barksdales are so much more well run than the police department is, right? So the way the Barksdales are is you've got Avon Barksdale on top. And the second scene after the Snot Boogie scene, you're in a courtroom and there's D'Angelo Barksdale, right? And D'Angelo Barksdale is the nephew of the kingpin of this Barksdale group. And you got Stringer Bell sitting in the back, played by Idris Elba. And McNulty wanders into the room. We can get off on all that. Anyway, D'Angelo Barksdale has shot someone over it was a failed drug. They got into an argument and he shoots him like in the lobby of the terrace buildings that they run where they run their operation out of. And, you know, there's witnesses, it's sloppy, right? And so the Barksdales are this organization is very much, they've got rules by how they do things and it's very strict. And D'Angelo is kind of like the screw up, right? But he's family, he's the nephew. So there's some of that like nepotism. Like there's no way that dude gets any power in this organization with how strict they are if he's not like blood relative to somebody important. And he's blood relative to the guy on top. So up top, you got Avon Barksdale, who McNulty is sitting in on this. It's not even his case. You got Barlow down the hallway screaming at this dude about this quote that he doesn't like on some home improvement project. He's the detective on the case, but he doesn't care enough. That's one of the things you start to get established too, is that McNulty actually gives a crap and actually knows these people. And he actually has respect for the Barksdales because he's really irritated with how the Baltimore Police Department is run. And like, he sees that these guys are actually like, good at what they do, right? Like, they're organized. Avon Barksdale, nobody knows what he looks like. Nobody knows, like, from the cop side, right? But they're just starting to get, like, McNulty sees this trial flip because there were two eyewitnesses. The first one points out, like, yeah, it was D'Angelo that shot him. And then the second one's like, Nakisha Lyles, she's like, no, he ain't in here, you know, and basically tanks the case, right? So it's obvious that they have, that the Barksdale organization has, you know, made sure
done, they had done some witness tampering. The best right. part of that scene to me is the look on McNulty's face, like, it's like the scene in Anchorman where, like, the dog eats all the cheese in the refrigerator, and then Ron Burgundy's line is like, I'm not even mad. I'm impressed.
Yeah, right? That's amazing. I'm not even mad.
And that was sort of McNulty, right? He's like, I'm not even mad. Like, y'all got her to turd. Good for y'all. Almost.
That's right.
Right?
Like, that's right. No, he walked out. He was like, nicely done. To Stringer, right? And Stringer is second in command of this organization. But they've got all sorts of rules, like when they're driving away from, and D'Angelo's like, oh, you guys did this and that, and they're in Weebay's car, right? And Weebay's one of the muscle of the Barksdale organization. And so, like, they got to put up with D'Angelo's incompetent ass because he's blood, but they've got all these rules. So, like, Weebay pulls over he's driving his car. He's like, what are the rules? Like, oh, we don't talk about business in the car. No, we don't talk about business in the car because there could be taps. Like, and so they're super careful. They're really careful about sure. what they do. But so, yeah. So you contrast the Barksdales who are dealing drugs and they're gaining control of West Baltimore by being very effective at their jobs. You contrast that with the Baltimore Police Department, and it's like a lot of people either trying to get through their day or have been around so long that, like, nobody's going to fire them. Like, it's very much less of a meritocracy than it is with the Barksdales. And McNulty and Kima Greggs, who's just an amazing character. There are a couple of people that, like, really give a crap, but the higher up the food chain you get, the more people care about what they look like and, like, the political gains. So you got, like, so what happens is McNulty sees what happens and he tries to leave. And then the judge, who knows McNulty from his days as prosecutor, is like, no, get your ass in here. What are you doing here? And McNulty's starting to put the pieces together of, like, yo, these guys, like, got to a state's witness, and that's still a big deal in Baltimore, right?
Yeah.
And so the judge ends up calling McNulty's higher ups and really pisses off Rawls, Rawls is a major, I think.
Yeah.
He's below the, yeah. Or maybe he's deputy ops. Anyway. Yeah, no, he's a major Rawls.
Yeah.
And Rawls is, like, pissed off at McNulty because he got his ass chewed out by his
higher-ups. Rawls is always pissed off.
Rawls is always pissed off, yes. But you see Burrell, who's the deputy commissioner, who's above Rawls. Basically, all of these people are, like, political animals from that point there on out.
Yeah.
And everything that's done kind of trickles down. It's not about, like, being a good cop or being good at law enforcement. It's about jockeying for position politically and all of that.
Well, the thing I would say, too, and to me, this is one of the standout characteristics of the series, and it's one of the reasons why I love it, is because both sides play under a certain set of rules, and there are rules that really govern both sides, right? And so for all the criminal empire organizational rules that you just laid out from the Barksdale side, like no talking in the car, and you know, you're not talking to the police, and even when Avon ends up talking to D'Angelo about, like, after he got off, from, like, after he beat the murder trial or the murder charge, how he was talking to him about, like, why'd you even go about your business this way? Like, you're in a building that we control. You've got dudes up in the stairwell who got your back. You've got this, you've got that, but you decide you're going to shoot someone, right? Because you ain't got the heart or muscle to take this dude outside and just handle business, and you can't take an ass beating, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you So you pull out your gun and you shoot a dude. Like, basically, follow the damn rules, right? Like, either take your ass beaten or handle your business without killing a dude, right? Mm-hmm. Because now we had to go through X, Y, and Z in order to get you off. Now, the rules on the cop side are all about chain of command. And a lot of that is driven by the political implications of all of these things, because everyone on the cop side is, especially the higher up the ladder you go, is CYA, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about how they look and whether or not the way something looks is going to undermine their credibility and their authority in a way that does not allow them to continue to move up the ladder, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone is playing by this game. Except McNulty, which is clear, because he is the only one, really, in these first couple of episodes that is not sort of playing by those specific set of rules. He is more than happy to go outside of the chain of command. He is more than happy to sort of make up his own rules because he feels like the ends justify the means. Mm-hmm. And in a way, the way that both of those ideas are exhibited on both sides of this is super interesting to me, because you can see that both of these sides, both these organizations, right? The drug organization, the gang organization, and the police organization, both of these institutions are sort of both trying to figure out how we can get everyone in our groups to play by the damn rules in order to keep things on the up and up for everybody. And I feel like, especially in this first episode, you see how wandering outside of those lines mm-hmm. causes problems for the people yes. in power, and how that then triggers a bunch of ramifications for both sides, right? And it's really the jumping off of that idea in this first episode that, for me at least, hooked me.
That's it right there. It's these two organizations and the rules in which they operate. You see their flaws. Like, so one last thing. After D'Angelo screws up, right, and they get him out of this, you know, Avon is pissed off at him, right, for acting yeah. like an idiot. And and exactly what you said about, like, not being able to take an ass beating, like escalating the situation. You're drawing eyeballs and cops. And that's what Avon wants less than anything. Avon's not trying to be some flashy drug dealer that's in front of everyone's faces. They don't even have a picture of this guy, and that's exactly how Avon likes it. So Avon chews this guy out for drawing so much attention, right? For dropping a body in the middle of the lobby for everybody to see. But then a couple scenes later, they're having some banquet. I don't remember what it was for, but you see Avon in the back making food. And
yeah, D'Angelo, that's episode two.
That's episode two. Right. So yeah, D'Angelo comes in and he's with his girl. They got their baby. And like, when Avon sees D'Angelo, this is after this whole big thing went down where they had to get him off of a murder charge. He sees D'Angelo walk in. He's like, he's like genuinely excited to see him.
Yeah.
Because it's family over everything, right? So you start to see like what these people value on both sides of the fence. That's a good place to wrap it up. We're coming up on 40 minutes. We've got plenty of time to stretch this out. In the next episode, when we do the rewatch portion, we're going to talk about kind of who the players are, who the people are, and what they're all about. We got into a little bit with McNulty. We'll get into it with some more folks. And we'll answer some of your Lakers questions. We'll get into more Lakers stuff in the next episode. But until then, you've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic, got it. Magic fires again, and the Lakers win the game! The Lakers win the game!
Campbell in and out. The ball is tipped, and it's saved. 3 seconds left. Here's Van Exel. This is for the win. He got it!
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. An amazing performance by Kobe. Shot with his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me? I know Red Auerbach is rolling over.
Kobe hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal!
Are you kidding me?
How strong was that? A triple on a fall away in the corner with a shot clock down. Lakers by three.
Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Freddie pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
And the critical part was Beatrice jogging back. Didn't bounce the floor. It's a two-for-one situation.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Powell.
There's the move. Two, one,
miss it!
Bryant, yes! And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?